important to increase production. Let landlords pull the capital, former landlords, pull the capital out of the ground and start investing it. Labor very quickly becomes more productive for things that you wouldn't even think of. Like under the old society, where everyone's on the ragged edge of poverty, many people are landless, many people are beggars, many people are bandits. The majority of people are thieves. They have to be. When the crops get ripe, everyone has to send at least one or two family members to live in the field day and night. They cannot leave the ripening crops because if they leave them for a moment, someone else will harvest them. You come in the morning and your grain is gone. And now, and you understand that you rent scattered plots. You don't have all your wheat, say, right here in front of you. Dad's got to watch the big piece, and the son's got to watch the other piece, and the wife's got to watch the other piece, and they build little galliang stalk tents in the field. Anything for cover. And they got to stay, rain or shine, day or night, they got to sleep there, eat there, sit there, just to make sure that when harvest time comes, there's something to harvest. As soon as land reform occurred, everyone had their own land. Who's thinking of stealing someone else's crops? You're busy raising your own. And this whole question of guarding it just simply disappeared. It wasn't an issue anymore. Here you save God knows what endless hours of watching and so on. Little things like this increased production and gave people extra labor power. But obviously, it's the release of production through the private holding of small plots and through land reform has certain limits because it changes the motivation of people, it releases certain productive forces, it helps people overcome problems like having to watch their crops day and night, but it has limits in terms of the small scale of the production, the lack of capital, the number of days that people can work on their own land goes up because they make minor improvements, and in the off season they can work at it, but still there's heavy unemployment in the winter, nothing to do, and land reform is only a sort of lays the groundwork for putting China to work, developing the economy. It doesn't solve the problem beyond a certain point. Then the question is, how is this society going to develop? In what way, what economic forces, what political and social forces are going to be brought to bear to develop the potential that's there? In China, you had this choice of road, which would have meant very slow increases in production and the bankruptcy of most people. Or you had the choice of a cooperative road, which could really release the potential of the people very quickly. And the Chinese peasants chose the cooperative road. It began with mutual aid. You have a few scattered plots of ground and you share a donkey with four or five families. You probably don't own a cart, but maybe someone, one of your neighbors may own a cart and doesn't have a donkey or a mule. You begin to pool these things and immediately increase production. Furthermore, by pooling, you can get together enough capital to enter some winter production. Alone, you couldn't possibly even make bean curd out of beans, but four or five families together, 8 or 10 families together, can pool enough resources to set up a small bean curd plant, or a small ink-making plant, or a small dye-making plant, or whatever. Or they can pool mules and carts and transport coal, or some sort of thing. And immediately the average day's work jumps 10, 20 days a year. through this cooperative road, you can make steady progress in production and in transforming society and transforming nature. So what was only a partial liberation of forces through land reform becomes an increasingly effective liberation of productive forces through cooperation and collectivization. Each stage creates problems of its own. At each stage, the people involved have to make a decision to go forward or forget about collective production. For instance, the mutual aid stage is a very difficult one, because though there's great advantage in working together, since your property is private and the returns are private, there are many conflicts of interest. For instance, in the North China Plain and in the mountains of North China, the soil is impoverished and low in organic matter because people have had to burn not only the straw but the roots of the plants they've raised over 1,000 years or more. So there's almost no organic matter in the soil, and when it rains, the soil's soft mud that bogs everything down, but as soon as the sun comes out, it turns hard like concrete. Now, you have some crops growing there, and it rains. It's important to go out and hoe while the ground is soft. And furthermore, it's important to get the plants while they're small and the ground is soft, because within a few days, number one, the ground gets hard as concrete. Number two, the water spurts the growth of the weeds. And if you wait, you're going to get much more difficulty. So it rains, and everyone wants the group to come to his field first. And there can be quarrels about this. Even if you agree, set up some order of priority, and turn and turn about and take turns, the weather doesn't always cooperate. And maybe it doesn't rain as often as it should. Or maybe it doesn't rain at all. And so on. All kinds of conflicts arise at a low level of cooperation, and mutual aid is not a very stable kind of collective work. To solve these problems, you can either forget about it and we'll each go on our own, which doesn't work too well either when you only have an acre or two scattered in 15 places, or you can raise the level of cooperation to pool land. And once you pool land and you farm it jointly, it doesn't matter which field you hoe first, because you're all sharing from all the fields. So the problems that arise are resolved through raising the level of cooperation. But the Chinese peasants could not just establish full-fledged collective agriculture in one step. Property, of course, meant a great deal to each family, and they couldn't just pool it and forget whose field was whose, even though they might share the produce all around. So the original cooperatives, they held the land as capital shares, and their labor went in as labor days recorded, and then when it came time to share the crop, it was shared in part according to how much land you put in, and in part according to how much labor you put in. So this raised a whole new level of problems, because after a year or two, it's quite obvious, as yields improve, that it's the labor of the able-bodied young people, particularly, who are doing most of the labor, that's causing living to improve. And they begin to resent the heavy capital share going to families who perhaps don't have any labor power anymore, who once put in a fair amount of land but aren't contributing. So conflicts arise at this level, and they're resolved then by usually through democratic discussion and voting, by cutting down the capital share and increasing the labor share. And so a sort of primitive cooperative farm is gradually transformed into a higher level, to a collective farm in which no capital shares are recorded anymore. The land is pooled, the deeds are burned, you own everything in common, and you share according to work, not original investment. To resolve those conflicts, then, you move to a higher level still. And this higher level enables you to much more rationally use labor power, use land, mobilize for winter work, set up small industries, set up a village school, even a high school maybe, and so on. Once you build a cooperative of that kind, the productive power is much stronger. And then you find the average Chinese peasant, once they reach this stage, the average Chinese peasant is working 150, 160, maybe 200 days a year, which is an extraordinary, well, you might say, doubling of the of the labor power applied to the land and to the resources. If you realize that capital is nothing but congealed labor power, you can see that China's capital doubles when the capital available doubles when people work twice as much, and it's particularly when much of this winter work is put into capital construction, like irrigation systems or whatever. But these fully, what they call fully socialist co-ops, what in Russia they call collective farms, also raise problems, particularly externally, because they're like 100 families, 150 families. They farm maybe 1,000 acres, 500 acres, but really not a very big area. And they run into conflicts. If you want to bring water, then your neighbor's cooperative has to, they got to lose land. You want to plant trees on the mountain, but the other co-op wants to pasture goats on the mountain. And of course, the goats destroy the trees. There are many technical problems that arise from the small scale of the cooperatives that originally arose in China. Perhaps you may realize that North China is a very barren country. I described it in my book. But it really used to be like a landscape on the moon. The only trees that you saw were behind the walls of village homes. No tree out in the open could survive because someone's goat or sheep would nip it off as soon as it came out of the ground. And there were no forests, or let's say there were only maybe one or two forests left in all of North China. One that was northwest of Yan'an, an area of a few thousand acres that still had forest trees growing. It was such a phenomena that it was famous all over North China for the fact there's a forest there near Yan'an. There were no other forests anywhere outside of the mountains of Manchuria, which were way off in the other direction. But this was in a country that had originally been heavily forested. It's not that trees won't grow there. It had originally been heavily forested, but the trees had been cut down for construction and for agriculture, and then grazing had prevented their regrowth for 1,000, 2,000 years. And it was impossible to change this, even with the cooperative agriculture, because no group controlled enough area to prevent random grazing and so on. And such factors as these caused the growth of the commune movement. From an economic point of view, it was important that small cooperatives band together and jointly manage large areas, of several square miles or many square miles, where mountains and valleys and the whole ecology could be planned and used to the greatest advantage. By getting together in this way, the problems of irrigation were solved. Whose land to dig up didn't matter because you were part of a single organization and within this organization, you could be compensated for losing land here, get land there, and so on. Mountains could be set aside, and because you're all one organization, one can coordinate where the sheep and goats will graze, and so trees that are planted can grow. The underground resources can then be developed. You have strength enough to open things like iron mines, even drill deep wells and all sorts of things, so that by this larger scale of cooperation, one develops productive forces further. And through this development, the labor is more completely used, so that with the commune phase of agriculture in China, the average peasant is working 250, many people up to 300 days a year. And you might say, is this progress? It's better to work 50 or 60. Well, it would be under American conditions, particularly if you can rip off a livelihood like some of our friends. But if working 50, 60 days a year means you starve the rest of the year, it's a terrible fix. And by reorganizing the whole economy, the relations of production, the productive forces, so that labor power can be applied rationally to the resources that are there, it means tremendous progress for a people, and it means the liberation of the productive forces in the country. So that has essentially been the story in agriculture. The key has not been modernization, the application of modern technique. The key has been the reorganization of society, the change in the relation between men and men, and in a collective direction. This has enabled the people, the country people of China, the rural people, to begin to apply modern technique, to apply science, to apply mechanization, to use electric power, to develop the resources, say, for pumping, and to actually make and use pumps, and so on. The heart of the matter is changing the relations of production. The heart of the matter is political. Not technical. And in the wake of political change, the technical changes follow. And this has been summed up by Mao in relation to Chinese farming as collectivization must precede mechanization. Now, this didn't come without a great deal of struggle. There were people in China who thought just the opposite. They thought mechanization must precede collectivization. The proponent of this line was essentially Liu Shaoqi, who was the target of struggle in the Cultural Revolution. And his whole thesis was essentially a thesis of modernization of technique and command. And it was applied in every field. And his idea in agriculture was that it makes no use to change the relations of production until you have modern industry, machines, electricity, fertilizers, insecticides, science, developed by the society as a whole, and then one can talk about land pooling, large-scale agriculture, and change. Before this is available, One must simply have laissez-faire and let people enrich themselves as best they can and have a basic structure of four freedoms. The four freedoms of capitalism are the freedom to buy and sell land, the freedom to hire labor for wages, the freedom to loan money at interest, and the freedom to set up individual private enterprises. Leo's idea was that these were necessary for an extended period, and when industry developed to the point of large-scale mechanization, then one could have a socialist revolution in the countryside. Of course, if his line had been followed, you would not be in any position, really, today to mechanize agriculture in China. You'd have a class of rich peasants or kulaks in the Chinese countryside who dominate the economy, but still were not big enough to use machinery. They might have two or three times the land of their neighbors, but what kind of scale would that be when the average farm in North China is holding is 5 acres, so these kulaks would have 15, and you can't mechanize on the basis of 15 acres. So this question of mechanization before collectivization, simply a dream. It's not related to reality, certainly not to the reality of China. Now, it's true that in America, we had mechanization without collectivization. And it's proceeding at a rapid pace to the point of driving me, as well as many other farmers, off the land, or nearly so. Now these same problems apply in every sphere, and industry, education, military, wherever you look, the heart of the matter in building a socialist society and carrying through a socialist revolution is the question of politics in command, of transforming of relations between people, transforming ideology, transforming consciousness, and in the wake of this transformation, releasing the energy that has developed technique, applied technique, a transformed nature, and so on. The evidence is overwhelming. One of the, of course, the average response to this here in the West is that you can't build a society that way. That really an industrial, modern, productive society can only take one form, that is the capitalist form. And that this is a form that suits, that's related to human nature, that men left to their own devices, freed from constraints, will build capitalism. It's very hard with this point of view to understand how feudalism ever developed. Because it existed a lot before capitalism and for a lot longer time than capitalism in the world. But, you know, the early bourgeois revolutionaries considered feudalism to be a very unnatural system. The attack on it was that it wasn't in accord with human nature, that it constrained people and confined people and prevented people from doing what they ought to do as human beings, which is to enrich themselves. It put roadblocks in the way, and out of this arose the whole concept of bourgeois right. What is the concept? Bourgeois right is essentially to free the laborer from feudal constraint, to free him from any ties to the estate, and to place him on the market with nothing to sell but his labor power. So this is what bourgeois right means for the majority of people. It means that everyone meets equally in the marketplace. I come trotting along to sell my hands, and Mr. Rockefeller is there to hire them. And this is an equal relationship of bourgeois right. We're both free to do the best we can, to make the best bargain we can in the marketplace. And that was the original goal of the bourgeois revolution. And under these slogans, they smashed feudal constraint and they liberated the people from all means of production and from all security and from all ties. And they placed them by the millions as people who had nothing to sell but their hands, the labor of their hands. And this was, of course, a great step in the development of the world, but it had very serious consequences, which we're seeing today, and that's why socialist revolution exists. So, in the development of socialism, though, all these assumptions that capitalism reflects human nature and that the only way to develop productive forces is to free people from all property and place them in the marketplace to meet Mr. Rockefeller on an equal basis, all of these theories are challenged. Socialist revolutionaries don't accept any part of it. In fact, one of the goals of revolution in China is to do away with bourgeois rights and establish a system of socialist rights. And along with doing away with bourgeois rights, we do away with the difference between town and country, the difference between mental and manual labor, and create an entirely new world that is in which people are essentially are really equal and not just equal in the marketplace. Now, this whole question has meant that in China, they take these goals seriously. The goal of doing away with the difference between town and country, and the goal of doing away with the difference between mental and manual labor, is taken seriously in China. It doesn't mean that you merge town and country, but it means that productivity, culture, science, technique is as high in the countryside as it is in the city. It means that the rewards of labor are as high in the countryside as in the city. It means that opportunity, I mean, these are goals. These have not been reached, but the goal is that opportunities would be as great in the countryside as in the city, and so on. And between mental and manual labor, it doesn't mean that picking up a rock is the same thing as considering a problem. But it means that people who, first place, it means that the masses of people would be developed to do both to consider a problem and to pick up rocks. And that they would develop this potential universally, and that the prestige of thinking through a thought and picking up a rock would be equal, and that the rewards would essentially be equal.
WBAI New York.
And this is what is meant by doing away with the difference between mental and manual labor. This is an socialist revolutionaries take these problems seriously. Therefore, you have in China what Gurley, the Stanford economist, has called building on the worst. Any capitalist knows you can't do that. A capitalist always builds on the best. He looks over the country, he makes a survey, he gets an economist in, not a political economist, but an economist. He gets an economist in, and he makes a market survey, and he decides to locate his factory where? Well, where it's linked most cheaply to all other factories and to sources of raw material, where it's most advantageous in relation to the market, where he can hire the most skilled labor at the lowest rates, and so on and so on and so on. And he absolutely is interested in the best. Nothing but the best will do. And there he builds his factory, which means that he builds his factory next door to the next factory, and development of a huge city which essentially drains and lives off the countryside. But in China, they build on the words, which means that they consider that true economic development is the development of the full potential of the whole population and the whole country. Therefore, you don't just build a factory where you can make the most immediate profit, but you put the factory way out in the hinterland because industry is needed in every area, and raw materials are available in distant places, and people, peasants are there to develop industry and train themselves and develop in all sorts of distant places, and you take the material available and you build to bring up the whole country together and to bring the countryside up at the same time as the city, and